Okay, good afternoon and a good Erev Purim. Thank you, Rav Simi. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you for the financial group. And this will be likely our last in this series on this topic of wills and estates, Jewish concerns, and planning. I'm sure there are many questions. We've been saving them towards the end. So hopefully there'll be an opportunity today, and if not, maybe one more time. So before we continue with disinheritance, the question of changing the alignment of to whom we bequeath our assets. And again, we've gone through so many. This is, I think, part six of the series so far. So we've really covered a lot of angles and learned many of these tshuvos inside directly. But I want to go back to what probably is the most important in the core, but we only glossed over last time. And that is the issue of the shtar chatzi zachar. Let me share my screen with you so you have these source sheets. So I provided you with a couple of examples of addendums to a will, language to add to the secular will. And essentially, let me tell you the mechanism of it before we even look at it. So I'll share the screen again in a moment. But this method, this mechanism is what's called a shtar chatzi zachar. It is not dating back all the way to the Talmud or earlier. It certainly does not conform with the Torah's hierarchy or formula, the Torah's description of the way that assets should be distributed. But it does go back to the Ramah, and the Ramah is reflecting a minog that had existed for much earlier. The Ramah is in Eben Ezra, Simon Kuf Yud Gimel, and Echoshen Meshpat, Simon Resh Pei Aleph. And he writes, the Ramah, that the commonly accepted practice already in his time was to give each daughter a equal share in the estate. Again, as we've seen, and as we've mentioned several times, the Torah clearly delineates that sons inherit, daughters don't. We follow the line through the sons before we go up or to the side. A wife does not inherit, though a husband does inherit his wife. We've spoken about it significantly and examined it. So the question is, what if in contemporary times, and contemporary times, I'm talking about going back 400 years, 500 years to the time of the Ramah. For contemporary times, for these purposes, will reflect a very long notion of contemporary. But where we don't think it's wise to favor or to give the appearance of favoring sons over daughters, to be unfair or inequitable in dispersing our assets, and a person wants to include their daughters, a person wants to include their wife, though she's only supposed to be provided for from the estate and not inherit any portion or principle of the estate. So what are the options that a person has available? So the Ramah, both places, Eben Ezra and Choshen Mishpah, records that the commonly accepted practice was a shtar chatzi zachar. And the shtar chatzi zachar, the way the Ramah records it, essentially says the following. It says the father, at the time of his daughter's wedding, when his daughter gets married, in antiquity, and even until fairly recent times, a father provided a dowry for his daughter. The way you attracted the best suitor for your daughter was to provide an attractive dowry. A son-in-law wanted to learn, a son-in-law wanted a head start on life, a son-in-law wanted to be able to begin his married life with which he could begin. Provided to the daughter to pay her a large sum of money that would be due 1 hour before his death. So if a person's estate is worth $500,000, let's say, person's estate is worth $500,000. And a person wants to, after their demise, wants to be able to leave their daughter a part of the estate, they would incur a debt to that daughter. At the time of marriage, they would absorb or incur the debt, but the debt would only take place an hour before one dies. So a person has a daughter, they incur a debt to that daughter at her wedding, saying, I hereby am indebted to you. I ki'ilu, as if take a loan, I am creating a debt, a hischaivus, an obligation and a debt to you worth more than the value of the estate, and it is to take effect 1 hour before the death, 1 hour before the father dies. The debt would now pass on to the halachic heirs. So let's say this girl at her wedding who is getting the debt from her father, that her father will owe her $1 million or some sum larger than the sum of the estate, this daughter also has brothers, a brother or brothers. And when the father dies, an hour prior to his death, he will have incurred this enormous debt. And when he dies, who inherits that death? That debt, rather? The brothers. Correct? The girl who got married, whenever she got married, her brother or brothers inherit that $1 million debt. It gets passed on to the sons or to whatever other hierarchy would come before the daughter. Now, the debt includes a very important condition, a very important provision, a tanai. And the tanai in the debt is that the debt is void if the halachic heirs present the daughters with a share of the inheritance. And that were Chazal, this were our rabbis' very creative legal loophole, their solution that would enable us to circumvent, halachically, legally, to circumvent the Torah's hierarchy, was to create this hischaivus, this debt. A debt to the one you want to receive an inheritance, but who halachically is not entitled, you create a debt to those girls or to that wife, and the debt will be, the heirs will inherit that debt, but the debt will retroactively, the hischaivus will be chal an hour before the death, because you can't create a debt lachar misa, so it takes place an hour before the death. But the condition in the debt is that it is forgiven if the daughter inherits her portion of the estate. So that is all included in this addendum, which I'm sharing with you right now. As soon as I find that screen on my screen, I think this is it. Okay, are you seeing that addendum? Yeah? Okay. It is my intent that all transfers of property made under this will should be in sole conformity to Orthodox Jewish law. Therefore, for the sole purpose of meeting this objective, I provide the following. I hereby devise and bequeath the sum of, now you have to fill in the appropriate number here. I hope that you'll be leaving your children more than $1,000. So that is way too small a sum. It could be $1 million, $10 million, $100 million. Depends who. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates would have to leave a billion or trillion dollar, Jeff Bezos, to my heirs, as defined in accordance with halacha, to be divided among them in strict accordance with halacha. Each and every distribution or other transfer of any property under this will, except for the request set forth in subsection 1, shall be deemed to be made by way of gift effective at the instant prior to my death. Each such transfer by gift shall be deemed to have been completed through a proper kinyan, as appropriate for each of the properties defined by halacha. So that is one version, and this is the other, with a little bit of an introduction, and with this paragraph. Now, I stipulate that my heirs shall be given the option of paying the above obligation, or in lieu thereof, of carrying out the terms as specified in my last will and testament, and in addition, carrying out all transfers of property upon my death, in accordance with the state of the laws of so-and-so. If my Torah heirs abide by the terms of my will, then the above obligation is null and void. So you see the way it works? I hereby obligate myself to my daughter or wife, the sum of a number larger than my estate, but not payable until 1 minute prior to my death, on the condition that I don't retract it. And I hereby stipulate that in lieu of the debt, they can simply follow my desire, my will, as stipulated in the last will and testament. So that is the mechanism, that is a halachic mechanism through which the shtar chatzi zachar works. The shtar chatzi zachar works. Rav Asher Weiss thinks that the Maharil in a tshuva is the one, the Maharil that mentions the shtar Yerusha on behalf of one's daughters. And the fact that the Maharil mentions this notion of a shtar Yerusha on behalf of daughters, maybe he was the one who introduced it, maybe that's where the Ramah gets it from. What exactly is the source of this creative legal loophole is a subject to debate. Rav Asher Weiss, the Menchas Asher, suggests maybe it is the Maharil. It's not only the Ramah, but the Shulchan Aruch also indicates, the Shulchan Aruch rather does not quote this, so maybe the Sfardim did not have the practice widely, though today it is observed not only by Ashkenazim, but potentially by Sfardim as well. Now, what is an objection to this legal loophole? Why might you think that the Shtar Chatzi Zachar should not work? Any suggestions? We'll make this interactive today. Feel free to unmute yourself if you have a halachic suggestion of why the Shtar Chatzi Zachar maybe should not work.
It violates the Torah's original intent.
Okay, so does selling your chametz, right? The chametz also does. So does a prosbul and shmita. We have several legal loopholes, which this is not the subject of our shir, but the Reform movement famously threw in the face of the Orthodox that why do you have a problem with our negotiating halacha? You also do. Hillel created the prosbul. People weren't lending money because it would be forgiven. Those debts would be forgiven with Shemitah. So Hillel invented the prosbul in order to preserve a debt so that people would lend money to keep the credit system alive. You see, you can manipulate halacha. You're not allowed on any chametz on Pesach or after Pesach. Jews had warehouses originally when the sale of chametz was introduced. Then it was not done with the chametz that was in one's home. Jews had warehouses of chametz. They sold whiskey. And they had warehouses of barley and whiskey. And what were they going to do with those warehouses of inventory? So the Einfall came up. You'd sell it to a guy and the non-Jew would own it. But really everybody knew you'd be buying it back right after Pesach. So the Reform said, look, legal loophole, you're manipulating halacha, mechiras chametz. Prusbol, Mechirat Chametz, Heter Iska, a Jew wants to lend another Jew money with interest. Oh, we came up with the Heter Iska. Call it an investment with a return instead of a loan with interest. We came up creatively with the Heter Iska. So it would be a good suggestion, but that's not the reason. Because as long as you're operating within the halachic rules, even if the result is you've circumvented the halachic system, then it's not circumventing. It's part of the halachic system. Prusbol, Hillel invented the Prusbol because it's working, whether you assume it's the Beis Din holding the law, however you assume that the Prusbol is working, it's working in halacha. Mechiras Chametz is working because there's a bona fide, legitimate Kenyan. There's a Mechira. The guy, today, Junior, takes the responsibility in Boker Raton Synagogue and for several other shuls that we sell to him and will do soon, too soon. So Junior takes responsibility that if all the houses on Montoya Circle, God forbid, were to burn down and all the chametz in it, he would still own the thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars of chametz, even though all he gave was a deposit. It's halachically binding. So all of these legal loopholes work because the key word is not loophole. The key word is legal. Legal is in legal loophole. The key word is legal. So here too, it is a legal loophole and it works. So that's not a reason. What?
Question might be, was there a
Kenyan? Oh, so a question might be, because you went to your estate planner, the lawyer, who might not be Jewish, might not be an observant Jew, even if they are an observant Jew, and you sign a shtickle paragraph, you get this little printout, half a page, because you went to Goldberg's afternoon kolo shir, and now you spent a ton of money and countless, endless hours setting up trusts and estates, revocable and irrevocable, and all kinds of wills and estates, and at the end, with your enormous bill, you said, by the way, just watch me sign this thing, I'm going to stick it in the file, and why are you doing that? Ah, I'm an observant Jew, and we've got this thing, Torah says this is the way. What we've planned is entirely ignoring what the Torah wanted, but you'll watch me, I'm just signing it, sticking it in, and we are good to go. So maybe you need something more than just a signature. Maybe you need something more than a signature. And that is, in fact, a halachic suggestion. Some suggest that you actually need a kinyan. In order for it to be binding, you need a kinyan. Now, why do you need a kinyan in order for it to be binding? Why would you need a kinyan? Why would you be suspicious that it shouldn't be binding? What about this arrangement? What about the debt that the father, that the one who is bequeathing their assets, what about that arrangement is suspect or suspicious that you might require a kinyan to go with it? Someone tell me a halachic word. I can give you a hint. Shchimera. Okay, well, we spoke about maybe it should be binding because of Divrei Ameis, Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Ameis, Shchimera, but we concluded it's not binding just based on that alone. Again, Rabbi Natam said you have to give it to a shlish, a third party has to hold it, so that's not enough reason. Dina de Machus is not enough reason to listen to a civil will, and Shchimera or Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Ameis are not going to be enough of a reason. I'll give you a hint. Poker, or blackjack, or gambling. No? Okay. I see the interactive did not work. Rav Simi, note that we tried. So what might be the halachic objection to the Mishtar Chatzi Zachar? The halachic objection is the following. We have a concept in halacha called asmachta. An asmachta lo kanya. What's an asmachta? An asmachta, it's a big machlokas rishonim. Again, it's a fascinating sugya for another time. Asmachta lo kanya means if somebody entered an arrangement, but it's such an exaggerated arrangement that in fact, we are suspicious they were never sincere when they entered it. So exaggerated, so outlandish, that it's impossible the person had real das. For there to be a real kinyan, for there to be a real eschaivas, in order to have a real sense of commitment, debt, obligation, or transaction, transfer, there has to be gemiras das. A person has to really conclude, mentally. A person has to really accept. So if something's an asmachta, it's such an exaggeration, we are, therefore, say, asmachta lo kanya. Asmachta doesn't really work. Where does this come up? Comes up in Bab Metzia, comes up in Nedarim, comes up in several places. Comes up in the sugya of gambling. It comes up in the sugya of gambling. Why does it come up in the sugya of gambling? Because it says the following. Someone says to me, I'll bet you, we're going to play tennis, and I'll bet you $1,000 I beat you in tennis. So I say, me? Are you kidding me? Do you know what kind of athlete I am? I'm the best rabbinic tennis player there is. There's no chance you're going to beat me. No problem. I'll take the bet. $1,000. Now I lose in tennis. And you go to take my money. The Gemara says, when you go to take my money, I never really entertained the possibility I was going to lose. When I said, sure, I'll take the bet, it's only because I thought I was going to win. So when you take that money, you're a ganav, you're stealing. You're stealing $1,000 from me. Ah, it's rightfully yours. I made a bet and I lost the bet. So square up. So the answer is no. When I made the bet, if it made a bet that's so exaggerated, so outlandish, so outrageous, that we don't believe for a moment I really thought I was going to lose, there's no gemiras das. When you take that money, you might be a ganav. That's why the Gemara says that a person, mesachik bekuvya, if you gamble, mafricha yona, you pigeon race, you spin the dice, you gamble, and you take the money from the other party, you might be a thief. That's why you're pasul edus. Maybe you're invalid to be a witness if you gamble, because you're not only a gambler, you're a thief. How are you a thief? Because the other person didn't really ever entertain the possibility they'd lose, and when you took the money, now you're a thief. Now, that sugya is complicated, because Tosfos there talks about how do you avoid it being an asmachta while gambling? By putting the money on the table. If you put the money on the table. So how is it possible that a shul, that for a Jewish education scholarship fund, let's just give as a hypothetical example, hosts a poker tournament to enable Jewish education for children, as an astira minei ubei, you're going to violate a prohibition of gambling in order to raise money for Jewish education? I have an idea, lesson one for Jewish education. Don't gamble, you're a thief. So how is it possible we do that? So the answer post can bring down, again, the spirit of gambling is a separate conversation, osik b'yeshuva shel olam, whether that's considered to be a noble activity, but the act of gambling where you have to buy into a tournament is no smachta question. If to buy into the tournament you had to give $1,000, and you know the money's going to Jewish education, you're going to get a tax deduction, and you went to have fun, and you might win the tournament, and go home with a prize, there's no smachta. When it turns out that you were a hotshot who don't even know the poker rules, and you're the worst bluffer on the planet, so you get eliminated because you went all in on the first hand, we don't say whoever took your chips is a thief because you never thought you were going to lose. We say you knew you were going to lose when you bought in and you gave the money in advance. So Tosfos say when it comes to gambling in a smachta, if you put the money on the table, so then you are essentially confirming that you know it's not an exaggeration, it's not an asmachta, then the other party's not a thief. So the exact details of asmachta, when do we say asmachta, when we say not asmachta, is not for now. We could do a whole shiur on gambling another time. But the application for right now is that some would object, and they would say, if all you're going to do is sign a little paragraph that says, I hereby a person dies, and please God for your children and the tzedakahs that you're leaving in your will. You have significant assets. You're leaving them. Let's say you're leaving them $100,000. You say you're leaving them $1 million. You say you're leaving them $5 million. Whatever the assets, you're going to leave them. So in order for the Shtar Chatzi Zocher to work, you've got to come up with a number bigger than what you're worth. So isn't that an esmachta? Is that a real debt? You're creating a debt to your daughter that you owe that will be passed on to your son or sons who will inherit that debt. Isn't that the greatest asmachta there is? Are you really entering that debt? If your net worth is $1 million, so now in order for the Shtar Chatzi Zocher to work, you've got to make a debt to your daughter of $1.5 million. Are you really incurring that debt of $1.5 million? Is that not a great asmachta? So therefore, some poskim say, in order to show that it's not an asmachta, what you need to do is not only sign the clause, you need to do a kinyan in front of Edim. The way to show that it's not an asmachta, that you weren't out of your mind, that you don't lack das, that it's not an exaggeration, but that you are of sound mind and a sound decision and you're entering it of your own volition and fully, is to do so with a kinyan and to do so with Edim. Some poskim say you need a kinyan and you need Edim. However, Rav Shechter says you don't. Others say you don't. It's a big machlokas poskim. It will be a binding halachically if you sign it without a kinyan and without edim. But some suggest that you add a kinyan. The Pischei Choshen suggests that you add a kinyan in order that it be something which is more legally significant, serious, and binding, and reflect. Now, fascinatingly, Rabbi Jachter, when he brings this down in his essay on Shtar Chatzi Zocher, he points out there might be tax implications. There might be tax implications if you create this debt. Because it means when you die, the moment you die, your children have the decision whether to, in lieu of the debt, split the assets. But the fact that you created a debt of that amount, legally binding, because otherwise the whole thing is a halachic joke. So it has to be a legally binding debt. And if you create that legally binding debt, have you created a tax consequence and a tax concern for you and for your children? So some suggest that you should execute the shtar, and it should be kept with a third party, an Orthodox Jewish attorney or someone who's a trustee who will store it with a will and trust and present it only if the halachic heirs challenge the halachic validity of the secular will in a beis din. So that way nobody actually has access to the debt, but you incur the debt, but you leave it with a third party who only need to take out the shtar chatzi zachar to invoke this mechanism if in fact it is challenged. Rav Schechter says that shtar chatzi zachar does not violate the rule of ein brera as far as the Torah level obligations are concerned, even though the size of the share that the daughter will receive is determined only after the day of death, because at that point the halachic inheritors have to decide, do they want to pay the debt, which will be larger than whatever they stand to receive from the bequest, so it would be foolish, but we don't worry about Ein Breira, and we're not worried about that. So that is a little bit about the Shtar Chatzi Zachar. Yes?
What happens if you pick an amount 10 years ago, and now that amount is, you have greater assets than that amount? Do you have to redo this?
Yes. You have to redo this. Because if your amount, and I give that bracha to all of you, that you should have to redo your will, this the halachic will you should have to redo over and over and over again. May your assets grow so exponentially and multifold that you are constantly and consistently having to redo this portion, having to adjust that number. Again, why not just say $1 billion? And then, again, unless there's something I don't know about all of you, and if there is, I'd like to meet with you right after the shir. But assuming, why don't you just write down $1 billion? And the answer is, again, that's a smachta. Yeah, smachta. You can't name some absurd number, even with a Kenyan, that's going to be in a smachta. So you can't just say $1 trillion, and that way, no matter how much my assets grow, I'll never have to redo my will. It's got to be something a little bit bigger than your current net worth, but not so big that it's clearly an smachta. So what about the fact that today, so this whole Shtar Chatzi Zachar, the Ramah quotes in two places, was originally instituted at a girl's wedding and when she got her dowry. So today, dowries are no longer expected. So the Shtar is not going to be executed at the time of the wedding. So now we do this as a supplement to the secular will. So whenever a person is writing their secular will, and we spoke about the different ages, perhaps that a person should make sure by which they have their will, by the age of 50, we saw a connection to Yovel, you're going to return to the land. The land, God forbid, means the earth. But whatever age for which you're going to have a will, probably when you're married or when you have children or when you have assets, is a good time to make sure that you're deciding and determining where they go. So that is the time to invoke the Shtar Chatzi Zachar. What about the fact that there is no dowry today? So some poskim, I think Rizam Nechem is the one who says, we still have the consequence of the dowry. When the boy marries your daughter, he doesn't stand to get a dowry at the time of marriage, but if he knows that a Shtar Chatzi Zachar is in place so that his wife stands to inherit her father, that also makes her more attractive, just like an attractive dowry. So even though we don't have a dowry today, but a wife who stands to inherit from her father also has the same function in terms of being attractive as a dowry would. So we have a supplement to a secular will. It's written by a we'll get to a spouse in a moment. So a spouse works in the following. Again, only the husband needs this. The wife, the husband inherits her. And the husband, the hierarchy of the laws of inheritance, are not as complicated or confusing to circumvent. So really we're talking about the husband, although I imagine most often husbands and wives are signing their last will and testament, it is coordinated together. So really, if a husband wants his wife to inherit his estate, then he has to incur this debt, this legal fiction to her. That would again take place a moment before he dies and be forgiven if the sons choose to allow their mother to inherit with them or instead of them. So a stipulation is made that the debt is waived if the halachic heirs follow the dictates of the secular will. And again, some say there needs to be a kinyan sudr. Others suggest you don't need the kinyan. Rabbi Jachter quotes that there are at least 5 different versions of how to create this document. There are a lot of different versions of which one will be best. I'm happy to share with everyone, or if Simi can distribute it, the version I read to you, which I think very, very well captures a great in a paragraph, how to sign it and make it easy. Simple and straightforward. Again, Rav Schechter does not believe that there needs to be a kinyan. Others say that this should be done with a kinyan in order to show that it's not a smachta. Should it be done with witnesses, with edim, is subject to a machlokes, or is it good enough to sign it and to incur that debt, because that's what's going to make it, that's the mechanism through which it's going to work, and it's going to take effect, which the mechanism doesn't require edim, and so on. Okay. So all that was just a summary of the shtar chatzi zachar and how we do it. It should be added into the will, and according to some poskim, should be stored with the will in the hands of a third party. Dafka, it should be with the hands of the third party. Okay.
What does added to the will mean?
What does added
physically mean? Is it a separate piece of paper that's stapled on, or is it something that the attorney of record has to incorporate in his introduction? What does added to the will mean as a technical level?
So it's a great question. So I think it means it's an addendum to the will. I do not want to pretend I am a lawyer. I'm not. And there are great resources if you really are curious more about this, including you could find it online, but actually written by a lawyer and a dayan, Rabbi Yehuda Warburg, called The Propriety of a Civil Will. It's in Chakira. And there are many other things. One of my childhood rabbis, Rabbi Arya Weil, wrote an article about this subject, which is an important article on the subject. And Rabbi Jachter has written about it. Many have written about it. But I believe it needs to be added as an addendum to the will. So in other words, what I have on the screen right now, this obligation, I think it can complicate the will if you're asking the lawyer to incorporate it into the will. I don't think American civil law is structured to be able to incorporate this into the will itself. So I think it is simply attached, whether legally, whether stapled literally, or added to the folder, or scanned in the file, but it is part of whoever is going to hold the papers that will determine after a person's demise what their will and testament was. This should be included in it as an addendum. So it's these simple three paragraphs. There's a date, and then you sign, you put the address where you signed, and then that's it. Again, according to others, there should be witnesses. According to others, there should be a kinyan. But if you assume that those are not necessary in our stringencies and that you can leave them out, then this would be enough. Rav Schechter also speaks about this in the Journal of Halach and Contemporary Society, Spring 1981. You can Pischei Choshen, they have a big entry about this. There's endless resources to read more about this and understand exactly how it works. But that is the halachic mechanism and the halachic system through which it is working. This legal loophole, a very creative legal loophole that is taking into account that you cannot have a kinyan achar misa. There is no transfer after death, so the debt has to be incurred a moment before one dies. And also it can be forgiven if in lieu you split the estate based on the way it is stipulated in the last will and testament. But it's important that it be in there. It's important it be real. It can't be an asmachta, and it can't be an actual fiction. It has to be real. And most important is that the number that you name has to be larger than the net worth, than the real assets, because otherwise the halachic heirs have no motivation, have no incentive to, in fact, split. They'll take on the loan because it's lesser amount than the assets they're going to inherit. So a person has to be aware and update if their assets grow, that the number in the halachic will. So that's it, this whole page, the halachic will. It's one page and half of it's the introduction. So it's a half a page. It's a third of a page. And that third of a page, though, is critical. Because as we saw, that third of a page is the difference. The third of a page is the difference between signing a civil law, which might be gzela, which might make some of your heirs stealing thieves from the others, because they're not following what the halacha prescribes. So that paragraph will make the difference of your conscience knowing that you're doing what's halachically correct, but also positioning and setting up your heirs for success and righteousness to know that they are not running into any complicated or cloudy area of taking from one another. Okay, the one area that I wanted to conclude with, we're not going to have a lot of time right now, so we may not finish, is the area of disinheritance. And we started to see that. Was the Mishnah here in Baba Basra. The Mishnah in Baba Basra says that if you disinherit your children and give the money away to others, it's valid, but ein ruach hacham nocha imenu, it's not a nice thing to do. Shimon Gamliel comes along and he says, what do you mean? It depends on your children. If your children are miserable, complaining, negative, off the derech oisvarfs, then it's a big mitzvah to give the money to someone else and don't leave it to them. Zachor latov, you'll be remembered for the good. So how do we paskin? The Gemara said, we paskin like the first opinion. Ein rochachamim nocha emenu. Which the Rashbam used a very strong language to say, if you disinherit your children, if you, what we call, abure achsanta, you disinherit, you transfer from the rightful recipient. So you're transferring from the rightful recipient. It is not the right way to do it. So the Gemara, the rabbis are very critical. Shulchan Aruch records this halacha l'maisa. Kolanos in chazal lachem v'niyecha yorshin. Afi she'ina yorshin noagim bo kshura. Ein rochacham nocha emenu. Zachu achirin v'chamash nasan. Halachically it works. You're able to disinherit. But it's not the proper thing to do. It's not the right thing. Leave it to your children, even if they seem to be unworthy. Question is, how far does that go? So last week we left off by reading this question of Rav Moshe. And Rav Moshe was asked where three sons, two of them are Mechal Shabbos before Hesia. Two of them have intermarried grandchildren for you. And one of them is Eiskahalten. One of them is Yirei Shanayim and has frum kids. So maybe the portion of the two-thirds who are not frum, who are off the derech, and the children are intermarried, should give away to tzedakah instead of leaving to them. Why are you leaving them tzedakah? Why are you leaving them money? So Rav Moshe writes, Lani has daiti pashut. Make this bigger. I'll pretend it's for you, even if it's really for me. Lani has daiti pashut. Shano saying tzedakah vada l'shach l'asor d'chi adifi banav mihu atzma shbetzam harishayim and adin litein af rov mausel tzedakah. Ela shishay l'atzma mikta shalitein kom mausel v'asa miafusu mecharamim. So Moshe says, if you're giving it tzedakah, you're not disinheriting in order to give it to someone else. You're disinheriting in order to give it to tzedakah. So it's your money. It's your right. You're entitled technically to be able to do it. Moreover, Rav Moshe writes, and again, because we're running out of time, I just want to cover this. He says, "Amum l'chal Shabbos b'faresia, v'over malisuri Torah ve'ein mechanchem is b'nei on Torah mitzvos ein l'stapik bezar ma'alya." He says, and this could be true in his time. This was written in 1965, and the world has changed. And so, in 1965, if you have a child that went off the derech, the likelihood was that they weren't coming back, nor were their children. Today, the world is changing radically. There's a Baal Tshuva movement, and you don't know a person's future. The one way to guarantee that that person never comes back, or their children don't, is to disinherit them. And to disinherit them because they went off the derech. That's almost the one way to guarantee that they'll never come back. But Rav Moshe writing at his time, Rav Moshe wrote that if their son is completely abandoned a Torah lifestyle, then you're allowed to disinherit. That's not what the Rama was talking about. What the Rama was talking about was, what the Shulchan Aruch rather was talking about, and the Gemara was talking about was, you never know. Since you never know, it's Hashem's money, not yours. Leave it to your children and let Hashem make sure it ends up in the right hands. But if you know, and Rav Moshe thought in his time, 1965, that if a child was intermarried, you knew that they weren't coming back nor were their children, then Rav Moshe says there's no problem disinheriting. Mashma demumr mutal haver nachla mimenu. That a mumr, a child is a full-fledged mumr, it would be permissible to disinherit them, although it's unclear if Rav Moshe would say the same thing today, as we've seen that there are, today is really unpredictable, and stranger and crazier things have happened than people coming back on the derech. Rav Avadya Yosef also has a similar question. In Yabiya Omer Chelik Ches, Nishalti Ba'adam Sheishlo Shnei Banim, says Rav Avadya, I was asked about a person who has two children. Ha'echa Chacham Shetarasa Umnaso, Uvitarasa Yege Yom Avalayla. He's got a child who's stark, who's learning Torah day and night. And the other is Mechal Shabbos V'Hasya, Ubozid Var Hashem. And the other disgraces God and violates Shabbos publicly. So leave all the money to the son who's from, the son who's stark, the son who's learning. And don't leave to the child who's Mechal Shabbos. Is that a violation of Avurei Achsanta? Is that against the Mishnah? Ein Ruach Chacham Nocha Imenu? Is that against the Shulchan Aruch that you should not transfer away? So Rav Avadya has a very similar approach to Rav Moshe. And he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Yisrael Af Bishachati Yisrael Hu, Imkein Ein Lafkei Yerushan Mechal Shabbos. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew is a Jew, and you never know what pint of the Yid, what spark in the Jew is going to come back, and therefore don't transfer. Writes, even though in the time of Chazal, Moridin Ve'ino Malin, that if somebody's a Mechal Shabbos, then we no longer treat them by certain entitlements of a Jew, but the Chazon Ish says that's not true today. We have a concept called the Tinuk Shenishba. It's not true today. It's a different world altogether. Says Rav Avadi, Lefi Anaz Daiti, Ein Dvar Mechuvarim. He says, I'm not sure I agree. Kol Yisrael Davar Nachsanto Mishim Akivas Nachlo Doraisa. You're not allowed to uproot what the Torah wants. Vim Ein Kan Mishim Aburi Achsanto Ein Kan Mishim Klal. Afil Al Dvar V'yeshitza Shiyashal Yerushal Zemin Chosav Shiyar Arba Zuzay Yoser. V'lachein Yer Lani Az Daiti Ben Yidon Didon. So therefore says Rav Avadi, it seems to me in this case, Shemutal havi rov kol nachla levno chacham. You can leave money to the son who is stark. Uktas min achasa levno acher, and a little bit to the other. Uveprachish, but you don't sveik sveika. As long as you have this double suffix. Sov tavar kol nishma shemikar adin ein kol chshash. He says, in this case, you don't have to worry about the fact that you're disinheriting, that the rabbis would be upset. This is a wise disinheritance. Support Torah, and don't support the abandonment of Torah. Such extreme behavior of abandonment of Torah, that is not what the Chachamim were talking about when they said, don't disinherit. Such a disinheritance, you would be allowed to do. That is the opinion, that is what Rav Avadya writes. The Meiri in Baba Basra writes, in Choshesh Lahafsid Mamono, Yimnon Apotropos Azores Bishmirasim Yasim Amuta Lo Vidas Kona Mashatirtze Ta'ase. So the Meiri has a suggestion. And he says, if one of your children is not acting Keshura, one of the children is not acting properly, the answer is not to disinherit, the answer is to put it in the hands of a trustee and to give the opportunity for that heir to act in a way that they can earn it. And the Pesach Choshen quotes the Salach L'maisa, source 50. Stechem and Hevi B'shem Hilchos Ketanos. So can you give it to a trustee? We spoke about this earlier. Set up a trust that has conditions. So you have a child who you are concerned is not going to live the values that you want. So you're not disinheriting, which would be a violation of the Ruach HaChamim. You're not disinheriting, which would be a violation of the spirit of what the rabbis wanted, but you're also not going to give it to them, which would be a violation of what you want of your values. What is the pshara? The pshara is, put it in the hands of a trust, of a trustee, and let them earn it. If in fact they behave in the way, then they can earn it. And if not, then they won't. The question comes up, though, coming back to our Shtar Chatzi Zachar. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg Zatzal, in Tchumen, in an article in the journal called Tchumen, source 51, Rav Zalman Nechemya, rather, has a discussion. Why isn't the Shtar Chatzi Zachar, the mechanism that we're using in order to bequeath to daughters, in addition to sons, why isn't that a violation of Avur Achsanta? Isn't that disinheriting? May not be entirely disinheriting the son, but aren't you at least partially disinheriting the son in favor of daughters or in favor of a wife? So using the mechanism of the Shtar Chatzi Zachar, why isn't that a violation of disinheriting? So there's several possible answers. The Gemara in Ksuba says that you're allowed to divert money to a daughter to improve her marriage prospects. If the reason you're giving your daughter money is as a dowry, to enable her to be married, then you're allowed to. So this is where Rav Zalman Nechemya comes along and says what I told you earlier, namely, that you're improving her marriage prospect by a prospective husband knowing that she stands to inherit her father. If she stood to get nothing and only her brothers got everything, who would want to marry such a girl? But if you know that the halachic mechanism that will enable her to inherit with her brothers is in place, she becomes a more attractive shidduch, and that effectively is the same, essentially is the same as the goal and the value of a dowry. And just like you're allowed to move that money for the sake of making her more attractive in marriage, so Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg says, that's why this is not a violation of Avur Echsanta, of this is not a violation of disinheritance. That is his answer. Others also, when Rav Zalman Nechemya points out that we've been using the Shtar Chatzi Zachar for the last four centuries without objection. The Ramah references it was used before him. Others have been using it for the last four centuries, five centuries since him, without objection. Clearly, the Shtar Chatzi Zachar is not a violation of Avur Achsanta. The Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss also, in his Minchas Yitzchak HaZetshuvi, or Simen Tzadihei, Be'inyin Yerusha Sabas, what is the mechanism through which a daughter inherits? Isn't that a violation of Achzuri Asanta? And he deals with it. And finally, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, we saw this already, but to see it again, Rav Yaakov Zatzal says, he says, Bizman azeh anachon v'hayashul ha'shachil kagun gam levnosav, ve'ein bezeh mishim ma'avir achsanta. Ava bevada yakbed shachil kagun yishar gam lebonim. Today it's proper to leave a portion to daughters. You want shalom bayis, you want harmony, you want peace, and you want everybody to get their equal share, but don't leave to daughters without leaving to sons. Make sure you leave a portion for sons also, but there's nothing wrong in today's day and age with leaving for daughters. So that completes our series, six parts on halachic considerations of wills and estates. We saw the Torah hierarchy, We talked about the Bechor is Notal Pishnaim, who is the firstborn who gets a double portion. We talked about a ethical will, leaving not only a financial will, but an ethical will for children. We talked about how to make sure those who are not part of the halachic hierarchy can halachically inherit as well. This addendum to the will, the Shtar Chatzi Zachar mechanism that gets used and that gets added, and the importance of it. And I hope that everybody will insert it into their will, and it should be a school of Arichas Yamim, that by organizing a proper and halachic will, we should be zocha not to need it to be used for many, many years to come. Yashikoach.